Ms. Stover, is there any time you'd like to reserve for rebuttal in reference to this matter?
No, thank you.
Okay. You may begin whenever you're ready.
I think that the best place to start is specifically in regards to willfulness in this case. Willfulness is defined as an act that is done purposefully, intentionally, and designedly, and that there are case law shows that there are two ways that the Commonwealth can prove the element of willfulness, which myself and the Commonwealth both agree was a necessary element in this case. First, if the Commonwealth proves notice, willfulness may be inferred.
And or, do you agree that that notice can be either expressed or implied?
Yes, Your Honor. Or the Commonwealth can independently establish evidence of willfulness. Now, here the Commonwealth argues that both of those things happen. The Commonwealth argues that it independently established evidence of willfulness due to these unexplained acts of a third party. What the evidence showed is that when the police officers came to the home, an unnamed third party answered the door and said that Mr. Chavez wasn't present. However, without any evidence that appellate orchestrated or was complacent with this conduct, that inference of his willfulness cannot be imputed from her actions.
Ms. Stover, I'd like to ask you about your sufficiency argument first, because obviously if you prevail on that one, the issue of jury instruction becomes moot. The Commonwealth relies on Hunter, and Hunter expresses several different ways in which you can at least make a prima facie showing of notice. Notice to the attorney, signing an agreement to appear on a certain date presumes that you then have notice of all continuances. Why wouldn't one of those types of implied notice here be sufficient to at least defeat your sufficiency argument?
There are two sufficiency arguments. Is the court referring to my sufficiency argument for notice or my sufficiency argument for willfulness?
Really on both, because both of them depend on whether the defendant received, quote, timely notice.
The reason that none of those apply is because there's not evidence of any of them. Specifically, I can go down the list.
Well, isn't there evidence that the attorney had notice of the subsequent court hearing? He showed up.
No, Your Honor. There's not evidence of that because the Commonwealth's brief mistakes the facts. The Commonwealth's brief says that Detective Asanglefac testified that the matter was continued to October 12, 2016. He did not. He only testified that the matter was continued. He did not testify as to what date the case was continued. He did not testify as to what time. He did not testify as to what place.
But, counsel, you don't argue with the fact that counsel for appellant was present on the October 12th date, therefore giving an inference of notice.
I don't contest that appellant was present in court on October 12th due to...
Or appellant's counsel was present on October 12th.
On September 30th and October 12th based on the testimony of the officer. However, that does not mean that counsel was present having to do with that issue or counsel was present having to do specifically or received notice at that time.
Okay. Detective Asanglefac was... Let's go to the notice issue. Specifically, notice itself is not an element of the crime. It's something that informs the willfulness. Is that correct?
I don't agree with that, no, Your Honor.
Okay. What's the basis for the disagreement with that?
The disagreement is in regards to whether a person needs to, in fact, know actually or constructively, that would be an element for a person to fail to appear in court as a preliminary matter.
Where is that present in 19.2.128? Where does that work?
It's nowhere present. It's also not present in 46.2300, which is not no operator's license. It's also not present in 46.2301, which is driving suspended.
But there are other parts of 46.2301 that talk about notice that's not specifically contained in that particular statute.
That is correct, but nowhere in 300 is.
Hang on. Is there a reference, though, that you can point to from another statute or anywhere that informs us that notice is an element of 19.2.128?
No, Your Honor, not in that statute.
Okay.
It's not in that
actually
statute.
Are you referring then to case law such as Thomas that talks about notice?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Well, doesn't that in Edmonds, which Thomas is basically relying on, which was written actually by Judge Annunziata, talks about the fact in a broader perspective, that notice really informs willfulness.
It says that if the Commonwealth proves notice, then on that evidence alone, a juror or a fact finder can find that willfulness is proven as well. I don't think that that ultimately precludes that notice is an element of the offense. I think
but
there
could be.
But
isn't that talking about notice then in a broader sense of how you determine willfulness? It's a part of the way that the trier of fact can in fact determine willfulness.
I think that those two things can exist and not be mutually exclusive. I think that willfulness is broader than just notice. I think notice can be part of willfulness, and I think every single case the Commonwealth would need to show notice. But willfulness is larger than that. Willfulness also extends to the cases or situations when a person is aware of court but can't get there because maybe they're in jail or maybe they're in a hospital or maybe they were sitting in another courtroom and they didn't willfully not appear. So while notice could be a portion, and I think that the jury also could be instructed that if notice is proven, you may infer willfulness, it is not sufficient in itself. I would argue to this court that it would stand to reason this is a criminal case. Not only is that it's a felony criminal case, that at a bare minimum, drawing on all the canons of construction, that one would have to, as a preliminary matter, prove that the person has some type of notice of the place and time in which they are supposed to be where they're supposed to be in order to be convicted. Now, to the extent that we're saying, well, notice really is subsumed by willfulness, if we all agree that notice is in fact a part of it, it should be its own element.
But notice, again, notice can be implied notice. It doesn't have to be actual notice. Would that be a correct statement?
I think based on Hunter, that is correct, and there's a number of different ways.
In this case, we have the warrant itself shows that on 10-12-16, that the case was continued to 10-12-16.
I would disagree with that, Your Honor.
It says 10-12-16 per date or wave, but it's clearly got a hearing date and time, 10-12-16.
I think that we don't know what that was because there was no evidence of that. All we see scribbled on the side is 10-12 for...
That's right under hearing date and time.
I understand that, Your Honor.
I'm from the country, but that seems pretty clear to me.
Which
it was set, particularly when you take that in conjunction with the officer's testimony. And the officer testified that the attorney showed up, so I would then presume that the attorney knew to be there that day.
Your Honor, I would disagree with the court because, as the court can see, it's under, it says 10-12-16, 11 a.m., and then the court's trying to presume or guess
what
at what the handwritten.
What does it say right above 10-12-16?
It says hearing date time J-9:30 PH.
No, but it, right above 10-12-16 it says hearing date and time. Those are hearing dates.
Your Honor, I understand that. There's nothing in the record to tell us when those notations went in, by whom, what they mean. There is nothing in the record as contrary by the Thomas case about how this notice was in fact given. In Thomas, the witness testified about, there was evidence about how notice was given or not given in that case, and the court pointed to those facts. In this case, what Detective Asanlefak testified merely to is that he was in court on October 12th. He wasn't subpoenaed for this case. He didn't appear for this case. But he was in court at the time, he said, and that the case was continued. He did not say to when it was continued. He only said it was continued. And then he said he was at court on 10-12 on that date, specifically on that 10-12 date was the date he wasn't subpoenaed to. He said he was present on that date. There is not the evidence that connects these dots, and that's the evidence in Thomas.
I'm going to read from the transcript of Appendix 124. This is from the detective's testimony where the question, it's line 2, it says, on October 20th, 2016, was Mr. Chavez present? Answer, he was. Was he in the company of his attorney, Ms. Stover? Answer, he was. What happened without telling me anything anyone said? The case was continued. So there is actually a reference, and then it goes on specifically to say that he was present again on October 12th. So there was testimony in the record that indicates that the matter was continued?
It says the case was continued. It does not say how that information, how that detective knew of that information at all. It doesn't say
Did it indicate previously that he was actually present in court?
It says that Detective Asanlefak was present. It says that
Doesn't
Mr. Chavez was present and
Chavez
his attorney.
And you were present.
Correct. But he does not say what happened, how he knew of that, and when it happened. He just says the case was continued. How do you know that information? Was Mr. Appellant or was Appellant and his attorney present in court at that time? That information isn't in there. In Thomas's case specifically, what they speak about is whether that person had to go before the judge.
But Thomas is slightly different factually speaking because of the fact that in Thomas, the court essentially said that the testimony of the deputy, who basically said he was present but couldn't determine where the appellant was present in terms of that matter, and that the information that the court gave about the process of the district court was never given to the jury, so they couldn't rely on it. That was a sufficiency case.
I understand that that was a sufficiency case as well, and that dealt with outside of all of the issues that the jury, that didn't go back to the jury in the procedure,
I'm asking is that distinguishable because there were deficiencies in the factual information that was presented about notice, whereas here we have information that the detective gives that he's present on September 30th, that the matter was continued, and that you and appellant were present. Can't the court at that point in time take from that notice was given? And then also to Judge Petty's point about whether the notice given to counsel can be imputed to appellant.
No, Your Honor. I would like to speak to the second point specifically. In regards to the notice to counsel, what the Hunter says is that it says notice to the attorney of record is imputed because you are implied to know all important stages of the client's upcoming trial. As a preliminary matter, I've argued and I maintain that the Commonwealth did not prove that notice was given to appellant's attorney based on the facts of this case. But further, what the testimony is that the court date that we speak of was a set date, which I would argue to the court can hardly be described as an important court date. He testified that he wasn't subpoenaed to appear on that date and that he wasn't present on that October 12th date. Detective Asanlefak wasn't present to testify in appellant's case. So the language, if we are to rely on the language of Hunter, what that information is imputed, it says, is about all important stages of the client's upcoming trial. I disagree with court in regards to Thomas and its facts. I think that there were more facts that were shown in Thomas in regards to what happened in court and what the deputy sheriff knew or didn't know. I think those facts...
Well, actually, it came out that the deputy sheriff couldn't recall whether the person was present in court or not. Here we have information where the detective testifies he was present when the matter was there on September 30th. Isn't that distinguishable?
I don't think that the Thomas case said he wasn't present or couldn't recall whether he was present in court. Specifically, I think what Thomas said was that he couldn't recall whether he had to go in front of the judge, which is different. Not necessarily you could be present in court and never go up in front of the court. And so I think that in regards to the appellant's case, all he testified to, all Detective Asanlefak testified to, is that on September 30th, all three parties were present, the case was continued. That can happen a number of different ways in court without an official proclamation that case got continued to that specific date on that date and there in court and that everyone knew of it. And so, Your Honor, I disagree that this evidence of this continuance date was known or was proven known beyond a reasonable doubt. And I say that because I think it's important that it's beyond a reasonable doubt. When the Commonwealth seeks an inference, and that inference, that fact, that predicate fact in itself is sufficient to prove an element beyond a reasonable doubt, then the Commonwealth needs to prove the predicate fact beyond a reasonable doubt. Because otherwise, we will be lowering the standard of proof and it will be a due process problem. And I would argue to the court, not only based on the dearth of evidence in this case, but that the Commonwealth did not prove it beyond a reasonable doubt that he received notice in this case. Commonwealth speaks about the difference between actual notice and constructive notice. I believe I've touched on the defense is not arguing that we didn't ask for any specific actual or constructive. We asked for timely notice, which is the specific language that Thomas speaks of, timely notice.
Well, timely notice can be either actual or constructive, can it?
Well, yes, I've not disagreed with that. I'm not disagreeing with that point. What I'm arguing to the court is that what follows thereafter are subsequent instructions instructing a jury about what notice is sufficient, what types of notice, and I think that the Commonwealth can lay out the things that are in Hunter, but I disagree that any of those things were shown in this particular case.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Curry.
May it please the court, Liam Curry again on behalf of the Commonwealth. Unless the court would like to steer me in a particular direction.
I'll take a shot at it.
Okay.
That's great. I'm talking about the sufficiency argument.
Sure.
Because I really do want to distinguish between the jury instruction argument, which would require, if we bought it, remand, retrial, and the sufficiency argument, which would be the end of the case.
Correct.
You rely considerably on Hunter as to Hunter's language involving constructive notice, when you notice or the defendant's obligation to keep current with his court date, the notice to attorney being imputed to the defendant. But I found it interesting when I read Hunter that it says after reciting all of these types of constructive notice, it said, the Commonwealth evidence in Hunter's case, however, went beyond establishing the minimum for prima facie proof that he failed to appear. The evidence showed that Hunter had actual personal notice of his trial date. So isn't all of that language about imputed notice dicta in Hunter?
Well, I don't think it could be considered dicta in the sense.
If he had actual notice, why do we care what imputed notice or constructive notice might be?
Well, I think the decision, which was an en banc decision of this court, was particularly well-reasoned because I think it recognized the difficulty in establishing
I agree with
notice.
You, but once we concluded in that case that he had actual notice, none of the discussion about imputed notice was necessary to decide the case. It was interesting. Perhaps we ought to adopt it. But it was not necessary for the decision, and that's dicta.
Well, whether it was binding on further future panels of the court, I think that issue's been resolved because other case decisions of this court have relied on this kind of imputed or constructive knowledge or a notice as a means by which the Commonwealth can prove willfulness.
So your argument is as long as we repeat dicta often enough, it's no longer dicta.
Well, I would say that once dicta becomes the basis to serve as a holding in another case to resolve that case, then certainly it would be binding on future panels of this court. That would be the Commonwealth's position.
Mr. Curry, speaking in reference to the sufficiency, Ms. Jover argues that in reference to the factual record, that we don't know when the matter was continued. In terms of the testimony of the detective, you know, how does that impact upon the sufficiency part of it?
Well, so the Commonwealth's position on this is that it is clear, and both parties agree that the counsel for Mr. Chavez had notice of the hearing. That notice was derived from the fact that he was physically present at the hearing in September. And I think the court and the jury was allowed to rely on its common sense to determine what present meant.
Is there any indication in the record that the defendant was required to be present on that date, that, quote, set date, as noted on the warrant?
Yes, there was, Your Honor. Let me see if I can dig up the page reference. But the initial agreement that he signs...
Was it the initial agreement for the September 30th date?
Yes, and that...
So isn't that sort of... That's the recognizance form that he fills out. So if we were arguing about the September 30th date, we'd be in a different position. I think he's asking more specifically for the October 12th.
There are lots of... I'm just aware of this from... what I did for so long, there are lots of dates that are set by a court just for the appearance of counsel to determine when the trial date is to be set, for instance. And well, those are what I always refer to as set dates.
Correct.
So I don't see anything in the record that says the defendant was in any way required to be present on that date.
Court's indulgence, well.
Well, why don't you, I don't want you to lose your time.
Sure. Well, my understanding from that document, which I don't have right in front of my eyes at the second, is that the agreement, he agreed to be present at all further proceedings in his criminal trial. He had specific notice from that agreement that he signed that he would be present at the September hearing.
You're talking about the pretrial release? Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yes, Your Honor.
And you can look at mine if you want.
Do you have the appendix? I have the appendix in front of me.
I have 264.
264.
I think that's the right page number, right?
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. One condition two is to appear, in fact, in this courthouse on September 30th and at time 11 a.m., and further appear at all times before any court or judge to which this case may be rescheduled, continued, which is important here, transferred, certified, or appealed. And so there was argument for opposing counsel concerning that this date wasn't important, but by his signing of that pretrial release, he agreed to be, that all of his dates were important, that he agreed to be there. So he can't argue on appeal. There was no need for me to be there when he had already agreed in writing that he would be present at such dates.
And if the language in Hunter is binding upon us, that would constitute implied notice or constructive notice.
I think it would be constructive or implied. You would also need it to be duly recorded on an order, which I would argue it was in this case on the warrant.
So that gets us past the, arguably anyway, if we buy that argument, that gets us past the sufficiency argument.
That's correct.
Then we're left with the instruction. And I'm looking at Thomas versus Commonwealth, although all of the cases preceding it say the same thing. And Justice Kelsey wrote, in this case, Thomas could be found guilty of violating 19.2-128 only if he received timely notice of when and where he was supposed to appear in court. So why isn't the jury instruction telling the jury that he must have received timely notice a proper instruction?
I immediately when I read Thomas, I took exception to that language because I did not feel that it accurately stated the law, and I think that it's clear that it does not.
That's out of my favor. I can't reverse him.
But if that language, this only if, is not, as the court can see, it is not taken direct. That language, that two-word phrase, is not taken directly from Edmonds. I don't need to remind Judge Annunziata of what Edmonds says. Edmonds says that when the government proves that an accused received timely notice of when and where to appear for trial, and thereafter does not appear on the date or place specified, the fact finder may infer that the failure to appear was willful. That does not create that this is the only means by which a conviction...
But you still have... I can't find any cases that say you can convict the defendant in absence of proof that he, quote, received timely notice.
Well, to the broader jury instruction question, I would just point out to the court that the instruction that was given to the jury completely tracks with the statutory language. It was the model jury instruction of this case. And there is no case law that says that the jury must independently find timely notice. In addition,
Ms. Schober had given an instruction that said that notice is something that can be considered in terms of willfulness. Would that have been an appropriate instruction?
Would it have been appropriate or inappropriate?
Appropriate in light of Thomas.
I think so. I think it's very clear that that's that's where the case law was when this matter was decided in the trial court.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Is your quibble with the fact that it should not have been included then in the recitation of the elements?
Yes, I think that is potentially confusing because it may... I think there's such a considerable distinction between having actual notice that that you were in court, that you heard that a matter was continued and that you were present at. I think that whether, well, let me start over. I think that it has to be an abuse of discretion not to have offered an instruction that has timely notice as an additional element of the offense. It may have been appropriate towards one theory of the Commonwealth's evidence that his failure to appear was willful. But I think including it in the elements of the offense, not as a separate instruction.
A defendant is entitled to have jury instructions given that are supported by the law. The law says it's not willful unless the defendant has received timely notice, actual or constructive. So I don't understand how the jury cannot be told that timely notice is in fact required for a conviction. No timely notice, it's not willful. No willful, it's not a violation of statute.
Well, I think the instructions that were given correctly state what the elements of the offense are. And the defendant also got a definition of what willfulness was. And I know or what the definition of willfully is. And there was an attempt by the Commonwealth to put forth an instruction, one of these, based on the theory that when counsel has notice, it's imputed to the client. But that instruction was I don't know if it was improperly not given by the trial court, but it wasn't given because the trial court quibbled over the actual, whether that was noted.
Well, let me attack it from a different point then.
Sure.
If the record, if the evidence was completely devoid of any evidence that the defendant received timely notice, actual or constructive, could the defendant be convicted of the offense?
So there's no evidence of timely notice.
Of timely notice.
That's a difficult question, Your Honor.
Because I think the answer is no, according to our case law. Can only be found guilty if you received actual notice.
Well,
so if that's required, I don't understand why a jury instruction to that effect is in any way improper.
So you're saying in the scenario in which there is no, there's no course of conduct that shows that
nothing.
There was, okay. Under that hypothetical that I would argue doesn't control this case, then I think it's theoretically possible that.
I'm not sure I understand how you can fail to do something when you don't know what it is you're to do.
Sure. And
I mean, isn't that what happens when you don't have any notice at all?
Sure. And the Commonwealth's position has never been that there is no notice or timely notice element or aspect to the case. It's just, it's implied in the willfulness that if you can't.
It covers it, you mean?
It covers it, yes. That you can't choose to do something willfully if you don't understand the consequences of it.
But then that circles back to Judge Petty's question. Yeah, if there's not actual or implied notice, then there can be no willfulness. Correct?
If there's no actual or implied.
If there's no actual notice or imputed notice through the attorney, then in a case like this, there would be no willfulness.
There'd be no failure either.
If there's no evidence.
There might be a failure to appear, but there would be no willfulness in that.
Right, that's exactly. It's really there are two issues under the issue of notice. It's knowing what you're supposed to do. If that's a violation of law, you just don't do it. All right, that was my question. How
sure.
can you fail to do something that you don't know what you're supposed to do? Then, under this statute, it also covered within the question of notice is willfulness. Your argument is if you show willfulness, you've shown notice, both knowing that any kind of, you've shown the knowledge you need to even establish a failure to do something. How you've failed is part of this statute. It covers both issues. My question is the same thing. If you don't know what to do, you can't fail at something. If you don't show notice, you can't find willfulness either.
If there is no actual or implied notice, I cannot imagine how you could willfully fail to appear.
Well, yeah, I think that's established, isn't it?
Yeah, yes. That's the Commonwealth's position, is that the willfulness element covers the notice issue, that notice was proven in this case multiple ways, that the defendant had actual notice by his presence in the courtroom when the matter was continued. He had kind of constructive notice from the fact that it was duly recorded on the records of the court, and he had imputed notice from his counsel's notice of both hearings.
Thank you, Mr. Curry. We're going to come down and greet counsel, and this will conclude our